You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we kicked off our conversation with Tommy Beaudreau, former Deputy Secretary of the Interior and partner at WilmerHale, to explore the global race for critical minerals. This week, Elisa and Tommy continue that discussion, turning to the legal and geopolitical challenges ahead, discussing international mining standards, outdated U.S. laws, and China's financial grip on resource development. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Elisa.
Is there a movement at all currently for any sort of international standards in the area of critical minerals? And let's just say that there is. How the heck do we trust China to be an honest participant in this? Because they've demonstrated consistently over decades that they won't be.
On this subject of international standards, including social standards and environmental standards, it is another dimension of the complexity here. And as you point out, the asymmetry between Western style expectations for social license and environmentally and socially responsible mineral development and the very different standards and approaches that, you know, Chinese and Chinese backed companies can take. There are a number of international principles and standard setting in the mining and critical minerals space. You know, one that gets a lot of attention and is advocated for by a lot of environmental groups is a set of standards known as IRMA, which has to do with what they would call responsible mining and assurance. IRMA is often presented by environmental groups as kind of the gold standard of operating in international jurisdictions. There are a lot of aspects of IRMA that I think are quite valuable and are best practices. I think there are also aspects of IRMA that the industry views as unrealistic or unnecessary or putting, you know, the industry at the kind of disadvantage that you're talking about. And there's also a level of complexity around all of this where you're talking about international standards as well as compliance with, you know, jurisdictional standards and jurisdictional environmental rules. And so there are also parallel efforts, some of which are driven by industry that has a lot of sophistication, obviously working across lots of different jurisdictions, including the Consolidated Mining Standards Initiative, CMSI, which is really an effort to bring coherence to this regulatory mix, all of which is informed by kind of ESG type principles. At the end of the day, those undertakings, in my view, are whether it's IRMA or it's CMSI or other types of mechanisms like Equator Principles, I think those still provide Western mining operations with some competitive advantage going into jurisdictions, including in Africa and Asia, to provide a level of assurance and security and transparency and economic benefit that the Chinese can't promise. So while on the one hand, I think it is valid to look at whether or not, you know, Western companies are at a disadvantage in light of these operating principles and environmental standards and social standards. At the same time, we have seen in places like the Congo and Africa, a pushback on Chinese operators and this feeling of kind of plunder that's happening. And so all of this needs to be viewed in a very realistic frame. But at the same time, these governance standards, as long as they're implementable and operationalizable, actually do carry some significant advantage in terms of building these kind of multilateral relationships and partnerships and restructured supply chains that are going to be necessary to enable us to meet these demands. And so I may be shown to be naive around all of this. I don't think it's necessarily a race to the bottom when it comes to operating standards.
On the topic of a race to the bottom, one of the things that comes up over and over again in conversations I've had over the years with people in national security about sort of mining generally is that we're not on equal footing when we go into places that were, for whatever geology reason there may be, are great locations for extractions of all kinds of things, because the country where those items are maybe is one that unfortunately has a culture of corruption. And some of that is around, you know, ethnic and tribal preferences in countries that were previously not countries. Maybe there was a template laid down and now you've got two groups that were previously sort of warring, trying to compete for control of the government. But we have a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And what that says in general is you can't bribe a foreign official and sort of feed into that corruption. There are exceptions to the law. But one of the things that the Trump administration has said and other administrations have done but not said is, you know, maybe we shouldn't be enforcing this. You know, maybe this places us at an economic disadvantage to China. It seems to me like the mining industry in particular, extractions and minerals, is one of the industries sort of more vulnerable to any sort of changes in the law or the enforcement of these laws. And I just want to draw you out a little bit about that. Get your thoughts.
Yeah, this is an area, because of the jurisdictional reasons you're talking about, when it comes to different international regimes around anti-bribery or anti-corruption statutes, the mining industry had to wrestle with those issues. Some of that's cultural, some of it's jurisdictional, some of it's economic. You know, more sophisticated international operators have actually developed over time very robust systems around compliance with, you know, these international anti-corruption statutes. It is fair to ask these questions, which are being asked in the current administration, of how that affects these companies' ability to operate and what are the trade-offs associated with it. At the end of the day, these standards and business practices create a important leverage point for international and Western style operators that I actually think can influence our ability to work in these jurisdictions in a way that will prove to be valuable. And there are expectations from North American, European, other communities, Western style communities, about these operations. And famously, Chinese operations in places in Africa take advantage of, for example, child labor. I think the tolerance level for international and Western style companies to distance themselves from, you know, those types of activities are important. And I think at the end of the day, actually are going to be part of what is necessary to restructure supply chain and sourcing around critical minerals to provide these countries with better options than they have and have been shown to have through the coercive practices of, you know, PRC, for example.
Yeah, child labor is always, I think, on the minds of people who are looking at these things. And I think a lot of corporations are, you know, incredibly good citizens in this regard in the United States. I think the separate concern often is that the particular leader that you're dealing with in the moment, or you may be paying to get access, even trying to get him or her to do the right thing, could then turn around and be a genocider. Nothing that an American company would ever want to participate in, but these things can and do happen, regrettably, in the world. Let's shift to something a little bit less grim. I'd like to talk about where we are in terms of the laws, because, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think we have really got modern laws in this area. I'm not sure why. It's kind of like we don't have comprehensive immigration reform. You know, we're talking about like sanctuary cities, and Congress hasn't really done sort of the hard work of doing some of the legislation that we need. Mining is a good example. Other big, big issues, they kind of just don't want to tackle them. Is this one of them?
I think most Americans would be surprised to learn or understand that mining laws in this country are still literally from the 1870s. Public lands are still governed by the 1872 mining law. That statute was designed in the Grant administration to facilitate, westward expansion. It was like the Homesteading Act. It was to provide economic opportunity and incentive for westward expansion through economic opportunity. So it's a prospecting statute. So it's literally, this is still the way it works. You go out and you stake a claim, and then, you do some mining and you try to patent that claim. It's not a leasing statute. It's not, let's figure out where the resource is and what environmental impacts and try to deconflict that. It's literally still go out and stake a claim. And there's also no royalty under the U.S. system. And so even if you do oil and gas development or coal mines, you pay the United States a royalty, because at the end of the day, those resources belong to the American people, and you pay a percentage to the federal government for it. Those royalty provisions don't apply to hard rock mining, the type of material we're talking about here. I think actually that the system is one of the challenges and barriers that we have to increasing U.S. mines. And there is a big problem with permitting mines in this country. It takes sometimes 15 or 20 years to get a new mine built, or even longer to get a new mine built. One of my lines, and I have an entire stand-up routine about the 1872 mining law, actually, but I'm not saying that we necessarily have to rewrite the United States mining laws every century, but maybe every other century we should take a look and see if it aligns with the current economic and policy imperatives that we face today. So I do think mining reform is an important area as the United States gets more and more serious about critical minerals as opposed to precious metals mining, that Congress should take a hard look at.
The only guy to ever make any money off the gold mine, right, was Levi Strauss. Good for him. Still yeah. A great product. One of the things I think people need to understand with respect to these mining companies is that the biggest players in the world have complex ownership structures. When I look at these big mining companies, I'm thinking like a Rio Tinto. I don't really know who owns these companies. I don't know if the ownership is really like an Indian owner. Is it really a Brazilian owner? Who has a hand in these big companies that have the infrastructure, the equipment, the security personnel, the geologists, everybody to go out into a place and do this very dangerous, dirty, big thing that we actually all depend on? Can you talk a little bit about some of those big players and why their complex ownership is an issue?
Some of it has to do with the types of materials. If you look at, say, the top 50 mining companies in the world, the top companies are still Canada, Australia, which have long traditions of mining and resource development. But again, some of that's a little misleading, because even in Canada, a lot of mining operations are really about gold, precious metals. That's the same in the United States. The truly like big international diversified, mining operators are still Australia, Europe, some North American, including Canada. And because these are global operations, they do have complex ownership structures and complex corporate structures, including particular structures designed for meeting local jurisdictional requirements. Those structures, just like the mining industry in general, have developed over a period of decades based on economic factors as well as capital and resource factors, as opposed to a lot of these emerging issues that we've been talking about around, national security, et cetera. And so as we do look towards developing additional sourcing, new mines, et cetera, there is going to be scrutiny on those structures, including through the CFIUS process, to get behind, from a national security perspective, trusted partners for these developments. As you go back and you look at the biggest mining players in the country, and there's different ways you can cut it, but Chinese companies and Chinese ownership are going to be in the top five of international operators out there.
Obviously, China looms over this entire conversation in such a massive way. But what should national security lawyers be thinking about? If you had to give them like two or three takeaways, let's say that you are practicing in a law firm somewhere, or you're interested in it, and you're listening to this conversation, you recognize that this is probably going to be a growth area What should national security lawyers in particular be thinking about, or any lawyer thinking about, with respect to potential national security issues they're going to have to tackle in dealing with this critical minerals extraction reality that we're in?
I think the number one issue has to be supply chain. As companies, you know, manufacturers, energy companies, national security contractors think about, like, okay, how do we meet the moment on emerging technologies? How do we keep pace with growth in artificial intelligence, data centers, all of that? There's going to continue to be intensified scrutiny on those supply chains. One of the main challenges is going to be the fact that all roads lead to hostile jurisdictions in this space. Working with policymakers to, in a thoughtful way, do constructive things to break those historical structures that, again, have been in place for decades while still allowing for the U.S. to keep pace is going to be the number one challenge. And there's going to have to be real policy guidance and determinations that shape how all of that is reordered. Because, again, it can't be done overnight. And it's not enough to say we can't have, you know, Chinese-based sourcing in things like drones or advanced technology, et cetera, because the U.S. and, you know, our trading partners simply don't have the capacity yet for that type of manufacturing. And so there are definitely policy incentives and levers that should be exercised to reorder those supply chains, but companies are going to have to think hard about their own strategies and what they would advocate for reasonable and sensible transitions to affect how those supply chains can work.
In terms of news that you're looking for out of the current administration, are there particular things that you are watching especially closely? We've had just a slew of executive orders. I imagine we're going to get a lot more of those. The Republicans do control both the House and the Senate at this point and could, in theory, advance a lot of legislation. You know, I haven't seen that yet happening. I haven't seen that sort of pace of things. But are there specific things that you're watching that you and your clients maybe are keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I think trade policy is top of that list. There's kind of the broad strokes around, you know, blanket tariffs, et cetera. But underneath that, I think there is going to be very focused and considered trade policy about specific materials. That's both necessary on the one hand to begin doing this reordering that we were talking about. On the other hand, has the potential for a lot of disruption. You know, in a world where there's lots of different geopolitical risks, I'd have to say the suite of issues that are front and center in the minds of a lot of folks I work with are keeping pace with these trade issues. And proposals that get at these underlying issues that we've talked about, but can do so in a way that's implementable and not counterproductive.
It's wonderful talking to you and hearing all of this. And I hope to sort of follow some more of the things that I imagine that you do. I know very early in my career that I interviewed at a firm that was focused on sort of, I'll just call it geology at this point. And I did not take the job, but I remember thinking that the legal issues sounded so utterly complex and on some level insoluble. And so I admire you for doing this work. I think it's really interesting. I also just wanted to ask you because, you know, we live inside the Beltway. I mean, literally inside the Beltway, but I think you grew up in a town in Alaska where a lot of what drove the economy had to do with oil and gas. What do you think people inside the Beltway or generally sort of maybe misunderstand about the perspective that comes from growing up in a place like Anchorage, Alaska? I don't have that experience, but my family lived briefly in Norway, which is a petro state, as you know, a lot of American presence there. A lot of people were there from Alaska. And it was very interesting for me to meet other Americans who their parents worked in that. What do you think we don't get or what do you think we do get?
Yeah, I think the one way to look at it is, you know, in the context of like energy transition, what an energy transition really means in places that are resource dependent states like Alaska and much of the American West. It's not simply a matter of fuel sources and jobs and that sort of thing. The reality is, a lot of the United States, especially, Western states and my home state of Alaska, have over a period of almost 100 years structured their entire economies, including how their governments are funded and tax revenues, around resource development and in particular fossil fuel development. And so any energy transition needs to actually grapple with, how do we fund schools? How do we fund emergency services? How do we provide for, the basic services that currently are supported through resource development and fossil fuel development in a lot of the country? And I do think we've seen that play out at a political level, where there are big parts of this country, when we talk about issues like climate and energy transition, where we're not talking about, fundamental issues that really impact the way people in, large parts of the United States have to live. And that's not about fossil fuels per se, but about the way our legal and governmental structures operate, that just converting to renewable energy doesn't do enough to address.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Tommy. I really enjoyed it. And I'm really glad that you came in to sort of set the record straight, help us understand these issues better.
It's been a lot of fun and absolutely my pleasure. And I couldn't agree with you more. These are the challenges of our time. I do hope folks find this conversation useful as we continue to think about what I agree are some pretty fundamental and important issues.
My guest tonight has been Tommy Beaudreau. He's the former Deputy Secretary of the Interior. He's now with the law firm of WilmerHale, and we've been very fortunate to talk to him. Thank you so much for listening to NSLT. Remember that it helps us a lot if you subscribe. If you have 1 minute to rate us on your listening app of choice, that's always helpful. You can share this podcast as well. We are committed to bringing you cost-free and intelligent content that will enrich you and make you a smarter person at that party or in any conversation with your friends, colleagues, or that annoying family member that you always get into an argument with on Thanksgiving. Be sure to share this episode with a friend and to discuss any of the topics that we have covered in a thoughtful way. Remember to hear other people's opinions and arguments. It'll improve your skills as a lawyer. The other thing that I hear listening to Tommy Beaudreau is it'll improve the conversations that we're having with other Americans, understand where we're each coming from and why something that sounds like a great idea to one group may sound like a threat to another. We can bridge these divides, absolutely. Remember that one of the things that holds us together in a country of greater diversity of thought is ultimately at base our unity. Our producer and writer and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity and nothing else. Our editor and my co-producer is the ever lovely, wonderful Frances Burkham. My other co-producer is the, oh my gosh, hardworking Holly McMahon, along with the amazing members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We look forward to giving you more content on energy next time.
Hey, podcast listeners, this is Holly, and tagging on to Elisa's great discussion, just to remind you all that the committee is now accepting nominations for the Morris Liebman Award. The deadline is March 14. We'll link to the nomination form in the reference section. But as some background, the Liebman Award in Law and National Security was established by our committee, which honors the memory of Morris Liebman, a distinguished lawyer, co-founder of our committee, and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The award recognizes Morris Liebman's lifelong dedication to the rule of law, leadership in the field of law and national security affairs, and continuing support for those engaged in this field. Persons eligible for this award must have demonstrated a sustained commitment and made contributions to the field of law and national security, whether through government service, legal scholarship, or otherwise. Again, we'll link to the nomination form in the reference section of this podcast, along with a list of past recipients. Remember, the deadline is March 14.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.